Today, I am pleased to announce that we are having a presentation on comprehension. This is a complicated subject, but we are going to be looking at the nuances around reading comprehension and its complexities. We have a wonderful guest speaker, Elizabeth Walcott. She's from Quebec, Canada, and she brings some wonderful insight in extracting the world of comprehension. And so that's the key about reading. It's not decoding all the time. The purpose of reading is to actually understand what we've read and why we've read it. And so she's going to be looking at ways in which we can help individuals that don't just instinctively learn how to comprehend information. And now they're able to have some guidelines and some ways in which we can help people to look at the world of comprehending reading and why they're doing that, so it becomes an interactive process. Today, what we are going to be exploring is what is the definition of some of the components of reading comprehension. We'll look at teacher strategies for conceptual contents for reading comprehension, as well as the teacher's role and being interactive with the student. So this is really a presentation geared towards educators and what they can do to engage students, strategies. We're going to have some wonderful resource material that is going to be covered as well on websites and different things that we can do to help individuals. And with that, I am going to pass this over to Elizabeth, and she's going to continue on with the presentation, and we're going to have some wonderful, insightful things today, and thank you for joining us. Elizabeth, over to you.
Thanks, Brenda. What we're going to look at today is reading comprehension, and in order to look at it, I'm going to just start off with a couple of definitions. The first one is done by Frank Smith, and the second from the National Reading Panel. I really prefer the first one because it emphasizes the active nature of reading comprehension. It's that striving to understand, and it also defines the context in which you're going to try to understand the world around us, in which we are particularly interested and involved. And the second one has a more of a research edge to it, I would say, and that students or readers derive meaning from text as they engage in intentional problem solving. To me, that sounds okay, but what do we mean by intentional problem solving? So I'm going to stick with the first definition, again, because of its active nature. I'm going to go on to the next slide, which looks at comprehension as a top-down process involving higher mental competencies and a bottom-up process involving complex interrelationships of specific skills. And although I've used the term top-down and bottom-up, it is not meant to imply that one is superior to the other. What it is meant to imply is that there are some very basic skills, which we will talk about later, necessary to comprehension. But the other part that's necessary are these higher mental competencies, and it's the integration of the two. And none of us comprehend in the same fashion. So some may use more of a top-down process. Other readers may use more of a bottom-up process. It will also depend on the text that you're reading. Narratives require very little top-down processing unless they have dense, meaningful text. And we sort of flow through them, whereas a textbook in physics or a textbook at any university level requires a top-down process. So let's look first at the top-down process. And Comprehension always begins with engagement with the text. We've all had the experience of reading a paragraph and coming to the end of the paragraph and not retaining one detail from that paragraph. In fact, if you asked us what we read, we really don't know. And that comes from the fact that we didn't actually engage with the text. So reading comprehension depends on that engagement, but it's a link between that engagement and the knowledge structures or prior knowledge within the brain that create understanding. And when we talk of it as being a top-down process, the knowledge structures we're looking at are higher level mental competencies. So thinking or reasoning or interpreting, imagining are some of those higher level competencies. People use words like abstracting, reflecting, any of those that require some sort of analysis and synthesis are top-down processes. Again, to emphasize that no one of us uses all of them at the same time. We emphasize one area or another area of those competencies to understand text. Now let's look at comprehension from a bottom-up process. Again, we're looking at engagement with the text, and we're looking at knowledge structures, again, and prior knowledge. But what we are not looking at is those higher-level mental competencies. We are now looking at content or topic knowledge. Most prior knowledge is limited to a specific content or topic of the text. It involves concepts that are involved in that text. So if you're talking about the environment, you're talking about interaction of different aspects of the environment, that interaction is a concept. And then it involves specific skills, which we're going to look at in one or two slides. All three of those pieces are important for an understanding of the text. Just to repeat again, as we go on to the next slide, is that knowledge structures depend on both the higher reasoning skills and the more specific content concepts and particular skills around decoding, etc., which we're going to discuss next. We use some of them at some time, some at the other at another time, but they all contribute to an understanding of text, and it's the interaction between them that produce understanding. Again, let me emphasize that first you have to engage with the text. So we're going to go on now and look at specific skills. Comprehension as a bottom-up complex of interrelationships of specific skills involves what is listed here, although some appear later on, and the ones phonemic awareness, decoding, and levels of morphology knowledge are in a developmental order. But the first thing that students need is the development of language and the breadth of vocabulary development, both of which are lifelong skills. So they begin as soon as the child starts listening to its mother and develops through stories being read to them, discussions about what's going on in the context, and continue being enriched by reading and life experiences. Listening comprehension, again, begins very young. They listen to tones of voices, but it becomes an important academic skill when students get to school, because they are asked to listen. They are asked to follow directions. The next one, phonemic awareness and decoding and levels of morphology knowledge, we're going to look at more carefully in the next few slides, but generally come phonemic awareness becomes preschool. Decoding generally begins in kindergarten, and morphology knowledge later on. All three of those contribute to fluency, which is a significant influence on reading comprehension. Finally, knowledge and use of strategies is something that is very school-based to a large extent, although children certainly use strategies early in life to get what they want. Writing is another way to express comprehension and to help in comprehension. We're going to go on to the next slide, which talks a little bit about vocabulary or word meaning. This links very significantly to oral language and listening comprehension. Vocabulary is divided into expressive, what the child can say, and receptive, what the child understands. Receptive being generally much more advanced than expressive. Receptive links to listening comprehension, which links to literal comprehension. So vocabulary is seen as a precursor for literal comprehension. And this is influenced by the percentage of familiar versus unfamiliar words in the text and how concrete the words are versus how abstract. The next slide talks about phonemic awareness. It begins with rhyming. So nursery rhymes, cat, fat, sat, rat, sang, hang, phoneme identification. Can kids tell if the words you say are the same or different? Did, hid, bad, bud, bad, bad. Are they the same or are they different? Phoneme blending is blending two isolated sounds. So if you have the sound ah and you have the sound t, if you blend them, you get at. Phoneme segmentation is the opposite of blending. You take the sounds apart. At becomes at, or ship becomes sh, it. And finally, phoneme deletion, which is you take off one sound. So say cat without the C sound, at. Spin without the S sound, pin. All of these are important skills in terms of flexibly approaching decoding. I'm not going to go into a lot about decoding because there are many programs that do decoding. There are some software that says they teach decoding. Basically, it's sounds and sound letter correspondence, and it's patterning or orthographic sequences. So patterning, I mean just like fat, flat, spat, any of those words that can be built from a vowel consonant combination. And orthographic sequences really just refers to spelling the same patterns that you have learned to read. The aim in decoding is for automaticity. And there's some information. I put a website on here where you can get some information about teaching decoding. I'm not recommending any software because at the present time, our research does not support adequately any one particular program. We're moving to sight word knowledge, which is common words, words that cannot be decoded easily. There is one of the more famous lists is called Dolch. They give you the first 100 words, the first 200 words that children should read, the first 500 words, and there's a link to a website that will give you the link. It can be done with flashcards. Again, the aim is for automaticity because we want children to become and students to become fluent readers. Morphology is basically adding suffixes and prefixes to words. So adding re, which generally means do it again, ed, which generally means that it's past, ing, by, un. And what it means is that if a child can decode the word play, he also can begin to decode and understand words that are built on the word play. Again, if you look at the previous website, you will find some directions about how to better teach morphology. What I'm going to do now is to give you an example of higher level comprehension. I think that this is an extremely important piece of what teachers do for themselves and that every teacher should think about the process of his or her own reading comprehension. Why? Because the complexity of trying to figure out how you understood a passage is revealing in terms of trying to teach children to do the same thing. So we're going to look at a passage that I chose for myself to read and go through the process of what I did when I was trying to figure out what the meaning of that passage was. So what would I do if I was asked to read this passage? I'm going to leave you a few minutes just to have a look at it, read it through quickly yourselves, and then I will read it aloud to you. Okay. There once lived in a sequestered part of the county of Devonshire one Mr. Godfrey Nickleby, a worthy gentleman who, taking it into his head rather late in life that he must get married, and not being young enough or rich enough to aspire to the hand of a lady of fortune, had wedded an old flame out of mere attachment, who in her turn had taken him for the same reason. Thus, two people who cannot afford to play cards for money sometimes sit down to a quiet game for love. Now, this is a leisure reading, doesn't require a huge amount of prior knowledge in terms of as compared to expository text, but yet if we begin to look at it carefully, you will see that I had to do a fair amount of figuring out. So the next slide shows my mental model or schema that I began to put together to better understand that passage. In the center is the name of the book from which it comes, Nicholas Nickleby by Charles Dickens. And I used inspiration and a template from inspiration and you will see that there are two characters that I got, Godfrey Nickleby and his wife, and I thought a little about them. They were not rich. They were worthy. The wife wasn't described very much. I got hooked a little bit on the word worthy, linked to the date, and I knew that it was a positive term, but did not imply wealth or higher social hierarchy. I looked at what were the themes, and it seemed like marriage was a theme. I tried to link that to what I knew about the setting. Devonshire is in the south of England. Dickens lived in the 1800s, so this probably took place in the early 1800s. I knew that Devonshire was isolated from London, and that helped me understand the word sequestered, which was confirmed by the word quiet. Again, there was a conflict in my head because Nickleby is the title of the book, and yet the character who was mentioned in the first paragraph of the book, his name is Godfrey Nickleby. So it appears that we didn't yet meet the main character. Having shown you a part of my mental model, you will see that I had to engage, I had to pay attention, I thought about, I reasoned, I abstracted. I didn't know too much about Dickens, though I love his books. I thought he lived earlier than he did. And I had to go and look that up. I began to interpret and guess what this was about. And I put marriage because I really felt I wasn't sure if that was the theme. And I could see that I had not had the main idea. So having more concepts leads to more patterns of links, and I only showed you some of them. So let's look. If you look at the bottom, I said Dickens lived in 1800s, and I'm just going to look at that piece in terms of having patterns of links. So the next slide shows what happens about what were my concepts about the 1800s? What were my concepts about marriage in the 1800s, about geography, family, social hierarchy, clothing? And you can see that I began to put down what I knew, but that really I don't know so very much. I got a little distracted by clothing, as you can see, but I had to engage more, I had to think further, and this was just a link to that piece about the 1800s. So it was a challenge. So this challenge was to identify my prior knowledge and misconceptions. As I said, I felt that Dickens had lived much later. Ability to use prior knowledge appropriate. Was I able to use vocabulary? Sequestered was somewhat of an issue for me. Language, because the syntax is very complex. What I knew about the author, what I knew about text structure, if the title of the book was Nicholas Nickleby, I hadn't met the main character. I thought a little bit about history and social history. So that was part of my prior knowledge. In terms of concepts, I chose that passage because, one, I like Dickens, and two is I wanted to indicate to the listeners how difficult it is to put words to your process of making meaning. I was trying to do for you, to some extent, a think aloud, but a think aloud that is done afterwards. So I talked about what it meant to me to engage, to pay attention, to reason, to interpret, and to imagine. And I didn't talk a lot about strategy knowledge, but you can see that I did use strategies to show you how I built my understanding. And I used a graphic organizer to do that. So you saw, I used two, actually. I started with inspiration, and then I moved and just did it with a draw program. I'm going to move to the next slide, which is just a bit of a precursor to the following slides, that it's important to teach strategies to increase engagement and attention, thinking, reasoning, and abstracting, interpreting, and synthesizing, and imagining, and symbolizing. No one strategy is going to be appropriate for each student. They will pick and choose the ones that work for them, which is why giving feedback is extremely important. And probably I should have added the word appropriate, because good work, or you tried hard, or good, or A, is not appropriate feedback. You need to show the child and identify what worked for him. You try to use a graphic organizer. It seemed to help you. Did it help you? That takes longer than good work, but is more meaningful in terms of encouraging the child to continue to, or student to continue to use strategies. The strategies we're going to talk about this afternoon are questioning and self-questioning, note-making, graphic organizers, and just some final simple supplementary strategies, which you probably all know. Asking questions is an extremely important strategy, asking questions of yourself, asking questions of others. And students need to know that there are different levels of questions. So a task in which you begin to find out about your students is to that the students have to develop one question to ask others in the class about a specific text. And if the answer is a yes-no answer, or if the answer is right there in the text as a detail, then those are lower-level questions. But if the answer reflects the student's thinking or reflecting or application of his prior knowledge, we see the kind of questions of higher mental process that reflect higher mental processes. So I'm going to show you some questions that were done as the result of an activity I did with a group of 9 and 10-year-old hearing impaired students this fall. They come from a book by James Rumford called Silent Music, about a boy named Ali who lived in Baghdad and loved to do dance. He loved to play soccer, and he was very enthusiastic about learning calligraphy in Arabic. And part of what I wanted the students to do was to keep his notes, the kind of questions they might want to ask Ali if they were to meet him or to write him a letter. So these were kept in little plastic bags in preparation for our final activity. But if you look at the questions, you can see that there's quite a variety. We have two why questions, which reflect higher level thinking, and then a yes-no question. Do you listen to music every day? Yes or no? Do you if you look at the posted on the bottom on the left, do you have hearing Do you have a fish? Do you have a TV? From a boy who has hearing impairments, who has a fish, and who has a TV. So he's a very concrete, very yes, no, very low level types of questions. The boy who wrote, "Do you like to play soccer in the team too?" At least it is a yes, no question, but at least he had picked up information that the boy liked to play soccer with his friends. What do you write with? A pencil or pen or marker? Again, a little above yes, no, but giving a choice is an interesting strategy, but does not reflect a higher level question. So these questions were based on some modeling I did, some practicing they did. We did who questions, we did what, where, when, and some do questions. The next slide shows you I had wanted them to write some how questions, and I modeled it by saying, how old are you? And we went around the class, and a lot of emphasis on how old are you. So instead of as a teacher trying to get other kinds of how questions, I failed to do that, and what I got back was this. So how old are you? How old are you? How old are your, how old your sister? How old are you? Again, stressing the importance of having, of modeling well with students. I didn't model well, for having them practice higher, again, higher level questions. I want to just come back to the piece that I started with in terms of looking at your own comprehension process. Self-questioning is something that we use a lot. So here you have the kind of self-questioning that preceded probably, definitely, the graphic organizer that I first showed you. I'm going to look at note-making. Note-making versus note-taking is a complex activity that requires engagement, analysis of information, synthesis of information, and symbolizing. It involves a written production process. So note-making is active. It's an auto-regulation process, which means that the student has to monitor what he's doing, evaluate what he's doing. This versus the note-taking, which is a term we've used for many years and really seems to imply that you take a note from one page and put it on another page. You don't evaluate it, you don't select it, you don't analyze it. And so just that difference is an important one for students to begin to understand. We're going to look at a text and look at some strategies for note making. This is a text, probably grade 3, about a fox. And the first thing students have to determine is what's the topic. Well, they can look at the title and they'll say fox. But it's more than about a fox. It's about the Arctic fox. And we need to teach them that the notes often appear in the first line of a text. The topics often appears in the first line. So as teachers, we have often asked students to highlight important words. Here they are asked to highlight important words, but when they highlight a word, they have to put it in a category. So they have to say the Arctic Ocean shows where the Arctic fox lives. And their note is not just the highlighting, but also the category, where lives. In the next sentence, we can say house cat isn't important. Why is it important? What does it tell us? It tells us the size or the weight. The next one, the word is wander. And what does wanderer tell us? Well, it tells us how he moves. And in the next sentence, tracks tells us how we know he's a wanderer. Now, I've chosen those words. Other students might choose other words, and that's fine as long as they come up with a category that describes how the word relates to the topic of Arctic fox. Now, the next paragraph uses a word that probably grade three students would not know, and the word is predator. So knowing that that's going to be a difficult vocabulary word, one can teach it beforehand, or one can do some elaborative questioning. So what we basically want to know, what the child to understand, is why the Arctic fox is a predator and what is a predator. So elaborative questioning means going outside of the text. What is the weather like in the spring, summer? What kind of foods do Arctic foxes live in the spring, summer? Same sorts of questions for winter. And then you can give a sort of definition, which is that the term predator refers to what they eat and how they catch their food. So we need to go back to identifying again what kinds of foods do they eat and try to make those links between predators and the kind of foods they eat, both in spring and summer and in the fall and winter. We need to think of other predators. And why do they need to be predators in the Arctic? If they can't answer that question, why are there so few animals or birds in that environment? And why does the Arctic fox need to wander in such a wide area? So this is the kind of elaborative questions that you might want to go into before you read that last paragraph. The other piece that you might want to do is to look at explicit pronoun referral. For example, its tracks have been found out on the sea ice very close to the North Pole. It needs to be clear who made the tracks and which word in the sentence tells us the answer. In the example I've given you, this is more evident than in some other examples of pronoun referral. For example, Peter gave Penny the hot dog because, and then there's a blank, was hungry. So who was hungry? He was hungry or she was hungry? That kind of difficulty is evidenced in children who do not have English as a first language and who may have language difficulty. So it's something to be very aware of. The other part of this is to draw attention to cohesive ties. You have to link lemmings and voles. What's similar about lemmings and voles, even if you know nothing more than what's on in that paragraph. They live in tunnels. They make rustling sounds. So you sort of know that they are small. You need to link rustling and pouncing. How does the Arctic fox know to pounce? And then what's a nestling and how does that relate to lemmings and voles? Again, I would look at the word it. It listens. Who listens? Or what listens to the rustling? And why is that important that we define that it's the Arctic fox that we're talking about? And it's the Arctic fox who is the predator and does the pouncing. So I've continued on with the word predator, and I've categorized it as how it gets his food, warm weather food, cold weather food. And I took all the categories, and I would like to have the students write a summary. And without looking back in the text, they can take those notes, and they will have most of the significant information about the Arctic fox. So the Arctic fox lives in the north near the Arctic Ocean. This is the size of a house cat, and they wander from one place to another and leave tracks. They get their food by killing other animals. They kill birds, and they kill lemmings and voles. They're an interesting animal. So they become prompts to help students do the summary. And again, without reference to the text, they have to put some of that into their own words. Again, talking about connecting reading and writing, because that is what writing summaries is about, just to go over quickly about the advantages of graphic organizers. Now, a graphic organizer can be in many different forms. I have done a cluster one at the beginning, and when I talked about my own learning, my own comprehension, and I personally like that, so I use it a lot. But there are other ones that we can look at, and I'll give you a website where you can find a variety of graphic organizers. But it provides a content in a reduced form, reduced processing demands, and the content is easier to understand because there are links, and students become more strategic learners. So here is another type of graphic organizers, which comes from this website, and it is actually an interactive one, so that you can directly type on the, you can print it off and use it, but you can also directly type on your computer. The key topic, i.e. the Arctic fox, is about, well, how the Arctic fox lives, where he lives and how he lives. And then you can go over some main ideas in the one about the Arctic fox. There's probably a couple of main ideas. But just in terms of different types of graphic organizers, I've made a list of them from this Learn site. Learn is a Quebec organization, but it was developed by the Ministry of Education for English school boards and English schools throughout Quebec who have limited resources, and is a good resource for anyone across Canada to learn about, or across anywhere who is English speaking, to contact, and they have a lot of material for teachers. This is another website. I've shown you some of the cluster that a graphic organizer, which I personally like, the hierarchical one. If you're doing an interview, you can put your questions on the left and your answers on your right. And what do I want to find out, and what have I learned, which is one that is used by a lot of schools. So go to EnglishCompanion.com and look at classroom resources. I've only given you a few. There are many others there. And depending on the task, you will probably find one that's appropriate. So in terms of supplementary strategies, you need to teach where to find main idea, how to write it down. You have to tell them the purpose of reading a text so that when I did my text, gave you the text at the beginning, I told you that my reasoning was that I wanted you to understand how complex the process was. But for students, they have to know, are they going to have to write a summary, in which case they might use notes? Are they going to have to answer detail questions, in which case their notes might be in a cluster graphic organizer form? So this purpose of reading the text, don't leave it up to the kids to guess what you're going to ask them to do, because that affects how they read. It affects how we all read. If we're going to give a presentation on something, we're going to read a text differently than if we're reading for leisure. Give kids that same, or give students that same information. Finally, I think self-monitoring cue cards, if the student can mark twice on a text, just randomly in a sense, that at these two points where they put a little dot or a little post-it or a little X, they're going to stop and they're going to self-question. They're going to ask what they understand, or they will ask themselves a who question. And you need to train them to do that. We, as competent readers, do it automatically. But students need to know that they need to know, and they need to practice. That practicing bit is really important. Just telling them to do that is not enough. Finally, you have to give that kind of feedback where you say you used X strategy, it seemed to help. You answered the questions correctly. Did you find it helped? How did you use it? Any sort of question, looking at and helping the child to identify what works for him. So, just to sort of finish up, I would like to say that positive feedback encourages motivation. So as long as you can give some feedback that's meaningful, that shows the child that you care, motivation can be there. And motivation underlies engagement. And engagement is critical for comprehension. So be specific in your feedback. Encourage taking risks. You tried this. It didn't work so well, but now you know that it doesn't work so well for you. So we'll try something else next time you do this activity. And give ownership to the children. They are the ones who have to identify what works and what doesn't work. Do we understand reading comprehension in all its complexity? No. But we're getting better at addressing this issue. And this is just was meant to be just a small introduction to one part. Remember that it is a whole process, and that each one of us does it differently with different strengths and weaknesses, and we need to be cognizant of that in students as well. Thank you.